Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to another live episode of Critical Q&A, number 445, in our live stream history here, in our progression of shows, where I get to talk to you, answer your questions, field your comments, get your feedback, and try to entertain, inform, and educate all at the same time. Multitasking, that's what we do here. Okay, welcome to this episode, the St. Patrick's Day episode. This is not green. I'm not really wearing green, but I don't know. There's green around here somewhere. Oh, yeah, my phone case. That's green. Okay, there's my St. Patty's greenery for you for today. I see all some of the usual suspects and critics in the comments here. yeah, just doing regular kind of collared shirt today. So not too many slogans happening. Okay, so let's switch over to the chat there so we get everybody up on there. Yes, that's right. When I put on a collared shirt, you know I'm trying to impress. I'm trying to. Ooh, Chris is dressing up today. yeah, exactly. You have to come around. Okay, so let's see here. I hope you all liked the podcast yesterday. I hope anybody who's watching this will take some time to go check out the show that I did yesterday, live stream podcast. First time we tried a Speaking of Cults podcast doing it live. And I got to go over and get some feedback from you guys while we were going through some of the tolls and problems and issues with, you know, taking on cults or taking on your abusers or fighting back. This has obviously been a subject that's been on my mind a lot in the last couple months, for lots of obvious reasons. And also for some not so obvious reasons, because I'm not, you know, I have my own life and my own, you know, approach to all of this and my own ups and downs and difficulties with trying to be a YouTube content creator and the vagaries of that, especially as, you know, an old dude doing it. Old white guy doing it. But beyond any of that cultural nonsense, there are a lot of people out there who I really hope can get to that podcast or that you guys can know are, you know, I'm not just talking about, you know, the problems that I've had over the years with doing this stuff. You go after your abusers, you go after your stalkers, you go after your cult leader, your guru, you go after your domestic partner who abused you for years, and it is an uphill battle of magnitude. It is never, ever easy. I don't know one person who's ever had it easy in taking their abuser to justice or even exposing their nonsense for other people, for some public shaming, you know? I mean, even trying to make that happen sometimes is quite the challenge. So anyway, just want to plug that podcast for this week. And also, shamelessly self-promoting, but the Friday show, where we talked about the four pillars, you could say, of human motivation and manipulation, the things that make us do what we do. I thought that was a lot of fun talking about that stuff. So, all right, let's... Ooh, I need to set up the... I need to set up the Q&A chat. Let me do that real fast. I should have set that up right from the get-go. Please put your questions under this comment here. Start Q&A. Okay. So now I've got the Q&A box up here, and that is what I am seeing in front of me, so I'm not paying as close attention to the general chat. So if you want to start asking me questions or throw them in there, that would be awesome, because then we can start on the meat of the show. We did have a question asked yesterday from Joe DiCeppo in the comments, and I said that I would take note of that and answer that question. So let's go ahead and pick that up first. Unfortunately, I did not create a little thing for it. So I'm just going to read it and answer. Joe asked yesterday, I was watching your show from last night on repeat. And you mentioned about how in the USA, You have the Pledge of Allegiance in schools and have to salute the flag, etc. This is very strange to many non-Americans, and I wondered what you think about that, given your education now. This might be better for the Q&A show. Okay, so great question. As to, you know, nationalism, patriotism, and the indoctrination that creates it. Now, as I said on Friday, as I've tried to get across, in a number of ways, the best kind of indoctrination or manipulation, and those two words are not always synonymous, so maybe I should just say the best forms of manipulation, are the kind that layer on top of our natural motivations, what we want to do already, right? Because if you can get somebody to do what they already want to do, well, that would be more along the lines of motivation than it is manipulation. And the reason I say I start my answer this way is because all of us are tribal. Every human being has an instinct and drive toward sticking with the tribe, sticking with the group, the community. And that's where all our social pressures and everything come from. That stuff doesn't just like come out of thin air, and it's not just taught to you when you're in first grade or on the playground. These are instinctive drives we have. This is part of our biology. We are built to get along, to work with other people, to cooperate. And that's intrinsic in us. It's a mammalian, you know, it's a mammal kind of thing. It's a primate thing. It's a thing. I'm not saying all mammals are community or herd mentality or tribal, but I think most of them are. And, there's Joe. Okay, so, I'm answering your question, Joe. So that is a thing. We all have a bias or an internal tendency to want to group with other people because that's where we get security and safety in numbers. And that applies just as much to our cultural and intellectual arguments and values and ideas as it does to the physical needs, right? We can be tribal, you know, as nomad hunters because it serves our purposes. It's not even like humans developed this. This is just built-in biology. So I say all that because everybody is biased towards or inclined to be favorable towards their geography, where they're born, right? Where they come up, their place, their location, their little home, their slot in the world. Oh, some people never leave it, you know. But we're all kind of inclined to have that tribal mentality when it comes to our nation or our nation state or our politics. And this is self-evident. I mean, I'm not like having to dig deep into any literature here to say this. And so when you gloss on top of that, the needs of a society, a culture, a nation, all the indoctrination of the children, the little people in the society that come up into that society are going to be naturally aligned to loyalty, steadfastness, right? Commitment, responsibility to that group, to the nation as a whole, right? It serves the nation's purposes to instill a sense of national identity in all of its citizens. And the utility of this is kind of obvious. I'm being really bare bones in my logic on this, okay? I'm sure that there are lots of high-level places we could go with this, but I'm thinking of this answer right now as kind of a brass tacks, kind of bottom-line answer to why the national anthem, the Pledge of Allegiance here in the United States is just one. These are just two examples of thousands of examples all over the world of how national pride and patriotism is instilled or created. And most people die within 50 miles of where they were born. So that it's in a nation's or a community's best interests to do that. It's not nefarious to create nationalism or patriotism. Now, where it can go in the hands of madmen and, you know, manipulators and crazy people, you can use that power, you can use that sense of identity, and you can drive people to behavior with that, right? This is how wars happen, this is how national defense happens, things like that. And that can be good, and that can be bad, and that can be judged by history in good and bad ways and all that. But the fact of national identity is actually a necessity for the way we have set up our societies. And it's really not that weird. It's just the group, it's just the big tribe that we're all part of wherever we grow up in the world. So, you know, the UK, for example, let me just throw this out as a counter to, you know, well, we in the other parts of the world look at the US and are disturbed by this, you know, this Pledge of Allegiance. Well, I get it. I totally get it. It's children. It's indoctrination. That is what it is. Let's not mince words. It is indoctrination. You're not asking these children to understand the words that they're saying when they first start saying them any more than I fully understood the Boy Scout, you know, points of allegiance or pledge of loyalty when I first voiced it. I didn't know what some of these words meant. This is just what you say, right? And over the years, you know, it becomes just this mantra kind of thinking, and it affects how your emotions and attitudes, right? So I'm not saying that it's not indoctrination. I'm saying that every country does it, and they just do it different ways. And one of the things that we all over here in the U.S. that I've had many conversations over the years with people about, for example, as a counter point, would be the U.K. royalty and the fascination and sometimes obsession, but certainly giving over of power and necessity to a royal family. It must be there. We have to pay attention to these people. This is very important. You know, some of us over in the UK look at that, in the US look at that and go, what the hell? Right? Now, I don't particularly have a big, I'm not, this isn't any big bash of the royals. I'm just saying it's other cultures have other ways of instilling this, is what I'm trying to say. Okay. So there we go with that. Let's carry on here. I think that answers the brass tacks of what I wanted to say about that. And we got lots of questions coming in now, so let's get to it. All right, and we can start throwing these up on the screen. Xion asks, if you found out about the Xenu story before you got to that level in your auditing, would that make you ineligible to do the OT levels and also afraid of it coming out in session? Yes and yes. have a Coke and a smile, right? Oh, Joe, totally. I know not everybody in the UK likes the Royals. Thanks for commenting on that. Okay, yes, my direct experience with this in a Scientology HGC, a Hubbard Guidance Center, where auditing is delivered to prep people for the OT levels and get them eligible and get them going on the OT levels, my direct experience in that room working on getting people onto the levels indicates that if you have been purposefully exposed, you have exposed yourself, in other words, to the OT materials, you are considered a security risk and you are not going to be eligible to get the OT levels given to you because your, you know, loose lips sink ships, right? And Scientology takes its internal security, the OT levels, very seriously, far more seriously than they should, given the fact that the internet exists and so much of the core material on the OT levels and Scientology's confidential stuff has all been leaked. It's all out there. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people have seen it. Nobody has died as a result of it. And the entire lie of L. Ron Hubbard's nonsense with the OT levels has been proven out over and over and over again. But within the world of Scientology, they got their rules and they have their security measures and they have their ideas about that. And so, yeah, if you find out about it before you get in there and you actually were someone who was, here's the caveat on it, right? Is it's not just that you heard it. that's not an out security issue if somebody just walks up to you or walks past you and gives you the clear cognition or dumps OT3 on you. You didn't ask for that, right? You're just Joe Blow Scientologist walking in the org and protesters are yelling at you or something, right? That's not on you. But if you went out of your way to scan, look for, look up, do Google searches on, you know, Xenu or Body Thetans or L. Ron Hubbard's past or any of this stuff, that's when it's going to become an issue. And you can forget it. I mean, the way it was communicated to me by the case supervisors who were overseeing the OT levels was he's never going to get on the OT levels. And it wasn't just one time. It was multiple instances of people with this problem. Just straight up, nope, never getting on. Okay. And then as far as, afraid of it coming out in session, yeah, you should be afraid of that because they are looking for your deepest, darkest secrets when they get you eligible for OT. That is, there's a whole security check called the OT Eligibility Security Check. It's a specific form. It's been revised and changed over the years. It's very long. I think it has something over, I think there are over 100 questions on it. Last time I checked, it was done FPRD style, which adds a whole nother layer of time and effort unto it. Excuse me. And that's what we have to say about that, right? That's how that is. Okay. Oh, I didn't know blue was the St. Patrick's color. I thought it was green. How interesting. Huh. Okay, let's carry on. OBG Foster, have you followed some of the scandals and issues of the Mormons? Yes, I followed some of them. I reported on a few. Last time I really checked in with the Mormons was on that whole bank scandal or stock scandal, the investment scandal, where they had a whistleblower was actively reporting that they had socked away like something on the order of $100 million or something of tax-free money in some investment accounts, and that had been falsely reported as charitable when in fact it absolutely was not. It was pure profit for the church. The Mormon church has assets and operating expenses that are far, far, far in excess of, you know, they're very flush with cash. Let's just put it that way. They got way more money than Scientology will ever dream of having. And this is just spendable cash just sitting there, right? There are so many things that the Mormon church could be doing. Seriously, no joke. You know, they're a church. They're a charitable organization that is ostensibly engaged in missionary work, you know, charitable work, good works around the world, sending out their missionaries to spread the word. Well, that's all bullshit. They have so much money that they could use to bring such powerful good to the world, and they do nothing with it. Nothing. That's the Mormons, right? Real nice people. To internally, within themselves, right? But like Scientology, they are hardly charitable. $150 billion. Yeah, it was an unthinkable amount of money. I said million because I didn't want to say billion for fear of like not remembering that right, but I thought it was. I mean, it's a lot of money. It's an incalculable, insane amount of money that the Mormon church is sitting on. This is above and beyond their operating expenses. They've got every bill covered, every person paid, every rent paid, every lease, every mortgage, every bit of operational expenses fully covered. And then there's this pile of money that they're just sitting on, right? I honestly have no idea how they get away with the amount of fraud that they get away with. The IRS turns a completely blind eye to the Mormon church. We're talking about money on the order of what the Moonies have. I mean, huge, huge amounts of money and power that money buys, influence and power. And you better believe the Mormon church leadership throws that money around as much as they need to in order to buy whoever they need to. They definitely do that. Oh, gosh, yeah. And then we get into the Ruby Frank, Jody Hildebrandt thing. And I did report on that when I was doing my news show, because that had just come out, that whole little flappy thing, right, about the Mormon mom and how abusive she was to her own kids, having them locked up, having them, I think, tied down and taped down to chairs or something in their home, not feeding them, not caring for them. It was disgusting. And meanwhile, she's running a YouTube channel about how to take care of your family and how to be a godly mom. The hypocrisy, the rank hypocrisy of the Mormons is really something to behold. You think Scientology's bad? Man, the Mormons are fooling everybody. They really are. I mean, it's a dark, dark place, the Mormon church. So that's why I'm looking forward to moving on from the Scientology stuff and really digging in on some of these other groups. I've done, you know, content. We had the Three Apostate shows. That's where we really got to look deeper into the Mormons, with Jonathan Streeter on, as you know, in one of the Three Apostate shows that we did. Where we got to compare and contrast JW's Mormons and Scientology. But I want to go deeper, and I want to do more on that in the future for sure. Man, there's just a laundry list of historical crimes, and it comes all the way up to the present. But like I said, the Mormons have everybody fooled. Very few people really get how nasty they are. I've called them a sort of a late-stage cult, or a cult that is sort of like tempered itself and toned itself down a bit to conform with society and become more mainstream. And that is true. But you know, but don't take that as me giving them a pass. That was never the intention of that communication. All right. Let's carry on here. Here's a real fast and good question. I saw an article called Scientology Linked UK Rehab Center Investigated by Charities Watchdog in The Guardian Saturday about Narconon UK being investigated for abusive practices. Is Alex part of this? You're goddamn right he is. Yes, and he deserves all the kudos. It was shameful that his name didn't come up in other channels talking about this. Alex is a tsunami right now in the UK of energy against the Church of Scientology there, and he is bringing it in significant and important ways, and everything he's doing should be supported in any way that you can. If you can help, please do. If you can help financially, please do. If you, any other way you can support coming out to the, you know, the work that he does, or the organizing, helping him organize stuff or work on stuff. There's so many things he's got going, and I am nothing but more power to him. And yeah, he definitely had something to do with that stuff, and more to come. And I'll let Alex explain, you know, give any more details on exactly what happened there, because I don't want to steal his thunder. I am just so happy with him and what he's doing. Okay. Let's carry on here. Ooh, so many good questions. All right. Jehovah's Witness apostate. Chris, governing body of JWs just announced that JW men can wear beards and JW women can wear slacks to the meetings because no longer have to wear just dresses or skirts. Yeah, I heard about this. And I also heard something today, a comment. I haven't looked into it yet. That the JWs are allowing people to speak with or associate with people who are disfellowshipped. Anybody want to confirm that for me? That'd be awesome. But this is something, again, the JWs, the Jehovah's Witnesses, or another organization like the Mormons I want to go real hard and deep on. And you will see future stuff from me on these groups. And yeah, that's what I can say about that, is that I heard the same thing. And it appears that they are trying to make some, you know, concessions. These are what you would call concessions. if this is true, and if this is actually happening, and the Jehovah's Witnesses are kind of, you know, stepping one inch closer to mainstream society, well, good. Good. I'll take any gains we can get, any move away from the us versus them bubble world that these cults create. I'm happy to see, but you know, I want to hear about changes with their medical policies and with their children policies. I think they are the ones who have the two witness rule and that kind of thing. That's what really needs to change within that group in order to see some, you know, some significant moves forward here. But I think that any progress is better than is better than no progress. All right. Oh, hell yeah. Chaotic Kitten. Hi, Chris. Do you have any advice for finding healthy people and making friends with healthy people after leaving a cult? Yes. Yes, I do. Pay attention to your gut. Pay attention to the red flags. Pay attention to, you know, the little voices, right? You won't always be right. And sometimes you'll be spectacularly wrong. But don't let anybody give you shit, basically. Right? Don't let people walk all over you or judge you or anything like that. Yeah, and that's, and I say these things right out of the gate because that's how you can kind of sift through who are the healthy people and who are the non, right? Is there's a lot of people who are going to, you know, who may reach out or want to connect or want to, you know, common cause, that kind of thing. And obviously we should, you know, be able to get along with people even if we don't always agree with them. But finding healthy people and making friends with healthy people basically involves watching, listening, and knowing that the first 90 days of any relationship is not necessarily the real person that you're dealing with. This comes out of the dating world, actually, but this little bit of advice on the 90-day thing, but it's I find it to be incredibly accurate and useful as a sort of a thumbnail rule. You know, or as a little bit of a benchmark, right, is don't go too in with anybody in the first 90 days. You never commit to anything. You never move in with somebody. You never get married. You don't, you know, go steady. You don't, like, commit to anyone for 90 days. And the 90 days is completely arbitrary, totally arbitrary, total bullshit, really. But at the same time, it's not, because 90 days is about how long someone can maintain a facade before the cracks start showing, before they really, before the real them starts coming out. It's about 3 months, you know? And obviously, depending on how often you see the person, how much interaction there is with them, the more there is, the more likely that that if there are red flags or if there are unhealthy points about this person's personality or life, you know, they're going to start becoming apparent within that time. So I don't mean to, you know, to set up an insecurity, a problem where, oh, you can't trust anybody. I don't quite mean it from that flow. More so as meet as many people as you can. Variety is really the spice of life when it comes to being an ex-cult member. It's really about sampling every dish, looking in under every, you know, nook and cranny. It's exploring. It's being very curious about the world. That is the healthy way to be coming out of a cult. And a lot of us, you know, I wish I was better back then about that. I'm a bit more open, a bit less opinionated, a bit less biased on my part. You know, I talked about some of that yesterday in the podcast, right? How we are when we come out is often how we still were when we were in the cult. And it's a process losing that. So give other people a break too. I mean, you know, you will make all the mistakes. We will say the stupid things. We'll cause people to get mad at us. And then we can blame them for it. You know, we can make all the relationship mistakes you make. But generally speaking, don't commit to anybody for 90 days. I don't know. It's a general rule of thumb for me. Maybe it's useful. Also, the other thing I wanted to add, Chaotic Kitten, to this. Finding friends. My best experience with finding friends has been to go out and do things or meet up with people, even on meetup.com or other social networking. Go out and do what I want to do. What interests me, what I find fascinating or fun or exciting. If it's hikes, go join a hike group. If it's seeing movies, go join a movie meetup. If it's eating, go join some foodie groups. What are you interested in? What appeals to you in life? What is it you enjoy doing? Go do that with other people who also enjoy doing that. And that's probably where you're going to find the basis for very good, very healthy relationships. So there you go. Well, here's an interesting question. What is my favorite Scientology book and my least favorite? Let's see here. Someone tells you to go take a hike. I think my favorite Scientology book is History of Man. I think it is. Because it's just so fucking insane. You know? It's such a work of imagination. And it was at a, you know, Hubbard, I don't know that Hubbard was ever on cruise control, but man, was he just really like out there at the edges of his imagination and really working at putting stuff together that was just the most ridiculous nonsense. And I truly believe that he bopped back and forth between kind of being committed and believing in some of it, and at the same time, oddly enough, also being fully aware of the fact that he was just selling these people a piece of blue sky. You know, like, it's just this kind of, you know how we all have different moods, and in the morning we can be one person and at night we're completely different. You know, I don't know about you. Sometimes that happens to me. Sometimes I wake up and I'm just a monster, right? And then, you know, in the afternoon I start chilling out, and then in the evening time I'm, you know, woo-hoo, everything's great, life is wonderful. I don't know if you guys have that, but I sure do. I think Hubbard was like that. I think sometimes in the morning he was just absolutely committed to the con, and later on he was like just laughing at everybody who would believe his bullshit. You know, he seemed to be both people in the same body. And History of Man has to be one of the most blatant examples of pure, unadulterated, complete horseshit being dished out as though it was scientific reality, right? So, and it's just so blatantly, obviously bad that I think that's what makes it my favorite. My least favorite is Dianetics. I fucking hate Dianetics. Sorry for all the profanity, but I just profanely hate it. It is the hardest book of all the Scientology books to read. I mean, 8808 is easier to get through than Dianetics. And 8808 is the one where he goes into all the weird electronic stuff. Like really crazy stuff is in 8808. But it's not the level of crazy I'm talking about here. In terms of my favorite, or least favorite, it was the hardest to read. It's just the hardest slog to get through. The wording, the language, the claims that Hubbard makes. He's all over the place, and it's frankly a very boring book. So, because it's way too long. It's twice as long as it needs to be. Just to make the, you know, the dumbass points that he's making. So that's my there's my take on that. Jehovah's Witness apostate. Chris, what do you think about JW men allowed to wearing beards and women allowed to wearing slacks to meetings instead of skirts and dresses? Oh, well, like I just said, I think that that's, you know, progress. And I will take any progress we can get. But, you know, it's a concession compared to, you know, the other things that the Jehovah's Witness organization is up to that is a lot more nefarious. So there we go. Young Matador. Hey, Chris, how should we treat defenders of new religious movements. Back in 95, some American religious scholars defended the Aum Shinrikyo cult. After the Tokyo Metro attack, Stephen Kent was angry. Young Matador, I have spoken about this. In fact, I have done, back in the way past, years ago, I actually took an academic book called Scientology by a guy named James R. Lewis, who was a collection of academic articles and write-ups by a group of scholars. James R. Lewis was one. Gordon Melton was another. There's a whole list of them. All of them academic apologists for Scientology. That's the label I assign to them. I have no respect for these people as academics because their research is lazy. I can fault them for their research, and I can fault them professionally for that, right? If I have any status as an academic, and I really don't have much of that, I have one published paper out there, and I have a degree, and I would like to do more, but academia's got its own issues in terms of price of entry there, right? But I'm working on it. I really am. And I've got, papers I want to write and stuff I want to get out there. So on that basis, I criticize these academic apologists because of their lazy research. They listen, they call up or get information from the Church of Scientology, and they ask no more questions. Their thinking is done for them by Scientology, and then they write a paper about it because, publish or perish. Here's a way to get some grant money. Here's a way to, put something out that keeps my tenure going, right? I mean, there's a lot of reasoning or a lot of motivations for why people would write lazy academic work. It's not just because they're personally nefarious, malicious, evil people. Most of the evil that's done in the world, if you listen to Hannah Arendt, is done through callous indifference, not because people are malicious. And that's the case with most of these academics, right? They just have their heads up their ass and they're lazy researchers. Or they have very strong ideas about First Amendment, freedom of religion, and freedom of speech, and they believe that those supersede the rights of victims of abuse, including child sexual assault abuse victims, female victims of sexual assault, etc. They don't care about that. They deny it. They degrade it. They say it's not true. They say us apostates are just people with axes to grind, and none of that really happened. Or if it did happen, not that important, right? Because it's just new religious movements. What are you going to do? Little baby religions, they have their growing pains and periods, don't they? Right? And it's all just academic bullshit for not engaging with the reality of these groups. There's no reason they can't be intellectually honest about them. Support the concept of new religious movements and religious belief while at the same time calling out abuse for what it is. There's no reason whatsoever that academics can't do that. And some do. Stephen Kent is a wonderful example of somebody who does that. Hugh Urban is another one. There are quite a few people out there who really do know what they're talking about. My professors, Robin and Linda Dubrow Marshall, are examples of this, right? We got lots of people out there who are on our side. When it comes to Gordon Melton and the likes of people who will go over, who did this, defense of Aum Shinrikyo, that was just embarrassing. I mean, those people, frankly, should still be humiliated over that. They went over to Japan at the invite of the Aum Shinrikyo cult, and they gave a press conference on how it was impossible for Ashoka Asahara, the cult leader, and his group to have created a sarin gas lab. It was impossible that they did this, and it was impossible that they were making sarin gas, and it was impossible that they were trying to poison a bunch of people in the Japanese subway system with it. While, just about at the same time that this press conference was happening, or within a day of it happening, the police found the sarin gas lab, and they criminally prosecuted everybody involved, and people went to jail, and the cult was shut down. And, these two academics who went over there had nothing but egg on their face, and they never apologized, never admitted they were wrong, as far as I know. I've never seen them do that. And that's who those folks are, right? So as you can see, I get kind of beefed about those guys. They're not helping. you know, they're only hurting us. They're only hurting people. And they're, and this, then this intellectual academic ivory tower sheen of respectability means nothing when you're just enabling cultic abuse. You just have no function or purpose there. You're just being part of the problem. And that's about as much attention and thought as I give to those folks, but that's my very honest take on them. All right. Let's carry on here. Yes. Ex-Scion, do you know anything about Scientology recently purchasing an office property in Melville, Long Island, New York for $15.2 million? Yes, I do. That is their new ideal org location in Long Island. They've been saving up for it, building up for it, and they bought the building, right? Just like the in Minnesota, they bought the science building. And, you know, in Albuquerque, they bought this other, you know, whatever. The people buy buildings. And that's just like, they're just their next step in Long Island becoming an ideal org. That's what I know about that. As far as I understand, it's some office property, and that's, I haven't looked into it in terms of location or anything. So I don't have a whole lot more intelligence, you know, intelligent stuff to say about that, but that's what I can say about that. All right. All right. Love Foo Kitchen. Aside from Ol' Laffy, of course, which cult leader of whatever kind, religious, political, etc., past or present, would you most like to sit down and talk to, and what would you most want to ask? Oh my God, what a great question. My first thought, and I guess I'll just run with it, is Jim Jones. I'd love to talk to that guy because he had a lifelong fascination with group influence and motivation and religious motivation. And he used to, you know, I say this because I, you know, there's stories of him growing up and where other people would play cops and robbers or play doctor, he was playing preacher. He had his friends sit down in pews, you know, and he would preach to them. I mean, this is, you know, he had like a lifelong fascination with this. And I believe it was sincere in his early days and truly helpful, truly compassionate. And then I don't know. And what I'm curious about and what I'd like to talk to him about would be the drug use and the political influence and what else do I not know? Because there's lots I don't know about Jim Jones's life, but I would love to, you know, kind of dig in and find out more about, you know, when did he turn? What happened that he went down or did something happen? Was he always on crazy train and he just hit it really well? Or was there a point where, you know, something changed or flipped with him and suddenly things got darker and darker and darker, right? And it went from human rights and compassion and anti-racism to control and manipulation and cult influence, right? I'd like to know more about that. I think that might be an interesting interview to do. And I'll tell you somebody else that I would really, really like to talk to, probably more than Jim Jones now that I think about it, would be Charles Manson. I really, really, really would have loved to talk to that guy about his Scientology experience and really put to rest, you know, the uncertainties about that and nail down the exact timeline. That would be something I'd love to do. That would be useful. Okay. Carry on here. Ex-Scion asks, does the PTSSP course contain all the materials in the CS1? Once you take the PTSSP course and pass all the check sheet items, you should never have to take it again, right? Okay. Little Scientology's there. I don't even know how I'm going to begin to explain. Let's see. CS1 is a term in Scientology for introductory clarification or education on a particular topic. There are three CS1s that I'm aware of in Scientology. There is a Scientology CS1, there is a Dianetic CS1, and there is a PTS CS1. It's a process or a procedure that is done with a person on an e-meter in an informal auditing session where words and concepts connected with each of those topics are cleared up thoroughly with the person with a sheet of definitions. In fact, they've actually put it into binders now. I've got them around here somewhere. That break down these principles. Oh, yeah. In fact, John Atack and I were going through, we did a whole couple of videos walking through the Scientology CS1. So the PTS CS1 is a similar but much shorter document or set of instructions on how to how to educate somebody on the subject of potential trouble source and suppressive people and how that works in Scientology. And that's done with an auditor in a session. You don't have to go in the course room and do a whole class. You just do this action, and it takes a couple hours, and you're all grooved in on how to on what it's all about to be PTS and what SPs are and how all that works. And yes, of course, you do pay for all that. Now, if you do the PTS SP course, yes, you learn everything that's on the PTS CS1. You will still have to do the PTS CS1 in session, and you will still have to pay for it. But, yes, you do learn all that stuff on the course. And as far as never having to do it again, I've done 3 PTSSP courses, personally, because the check sheet has changed 3 or 4 or 5 different times. They keep revising it. It's one of the most revised and re-gone through classes in all of Scientology. Probably the most commonly done class is the PTSSP course. Every Scientologist ends up doing it eventually, and a lot of us did it, you know, way many times. So, yeah. And the funny, you know, I'm just going to comment, just take advantage of this moment to comment on this, that it is so funny to me. Probably the biggest breakaway or change in Scientology over the years that any of us can see with our own 2 eyes is the change in the application of PTSSP policies. Because in the 2000s, when Anonymous first came out, is I think when this change sort of happened. I think it might have been predicted a little bit before that with some other changes that happened. The internet in general started changing this. It used to be that when you were declared a suppressive person in Scientology, they were formally, they would give you a write-up, a document, often multiple pages, laying out all your crimes, all the points that you had departed from official Scientology dogma, and why you were a bad and horrible and awful person, and why your only hope was to, you know, come to your senses and contact the International Justice Chief and get your shit together with Scientology and make it all right. That was the process that people were declared with. And it was a formal written document that would be sent around to all the churches and posted on the notice boards. And everybody in Scientology would find out that you were, you know, a mega prick, right? And you were a suppressive person and they couldn't talk to you or relate to you anymore. They don't do that anymore. They hide those declare orders. They keep them in files hidden away in filing cabinets. And they don't deal with SPs or protesters or attackers like they used to, the way it says to do in the PTSSP course. This is what's so funny to me, is the course has been in existence for decades. The latest versions of the class literally have the tagline on the materials that says how to confront and shatter suppression. Yet, when anyone approaches a Scientologist, they run and hide. They close up shop. They draw the blinds. They lock the doors. They just wait. They go into turtle mode. Go into the shell, right? They used to be fight. Now they're what? Freeze? Flight? I mean, what is that? It's not the PTSSP course. It's not what it says to do. It's the exact opposite of what it says to do. And I have never been able to reconcile in my own head over all these years, and I'm just ranting here, but I've just never been able to reconcile in the last 20 years how it is that Scientologists, probably the most blatant hypocrisy in all of Scientology that anybody can see, is they are told to confront and shatter suppression, and in the face of suppression, they run and hide. You know? And then they, and then OSA is tasked with taking out the SPs by the most underhanded, ruthless, vicious procedures and methods possible. Ruin their life. Destroy them utterly. But whatever you do, don't ever talk to them. Don't ever engage with them. Confront and shatter? You know, Scientologists confront and shatter them. I mean, they're shattering themselves, you know? It's just always been something that has just rankled with me about that, is just how blatantly hypocritical every single Scientologist is on that point, or just on that point there. All right, let's carry on. What do you know about L. Ron Hubbard's baby formula? Not a lot. I know it's kind of, I know a lot of people have very, very, very different ideas or opinions about it. I heard some mothers talk about how it was okay. I heard a lot of others say it had too much, and I might be remembering this wrong, but I remember somebody or one or two mothers complaining about how it had sugar in it, or there was too, or it was too sweet or something, or something wrong with it that way. I don't even remember the formula for it off the top of my head, but I just remember it kind of being generally rejected by mothers that Scientology mothers that I heard about it. You know, it came up maybe in all the years I was in Scientology, I think it came across my plate three times, you know, that anybody had ever had anything to say about it. So I don't really have strong opinions about that one. Oh, Jehovah's Witness apostate. What do you think about John A. Tack joining the Aftermath Foundation? Is he required to come to the U.S. for work meetings? No, he's not. You can definitely be a board member from the other side of the pond. I think it's cool. That's what I think. I think it's good. I think John is a very literate, very intelligent, very caring, and very empathetic person. And I believe that he is capable of seeing nuance, sometimes in ways other people cannot. He's been very, very helpful to me over the years in that. And I think he's going to be great. That's what I think. Yeah. All right. Well, here's an interesting question. What in your life are you the most proud of? This is a tough one. There's a few things that come to mind right away. My son is one of the first things that comes to my mind. The fact that I got myself out of Scientology is something I'm very proud of. Nobody got me out. Nobody talked me out of it. Nobody really was there for me in that whole thing except my mom and dad. And boy, did they have to do some heavy lifting at that time, you know, for me, especially my mom. But yeah, I'm really proud of that. I'm perversely proud of getting through the RPF, only because it was such a unbelievably difficult thing to do. It was the single hardest thing I've ever had to get through in my entire life, was the RPF. So that's why I'm perversely proud of it, right? Is because it was an endurance test that was absolutely a test. Anybody who's done it can tell you, and anybody who hasn't has no idea what they're talking about. It's its own thing. Yeah. And then I am really proud of having written a book, and I am looking forward to having that same pride in more books. I am very, very proud of the work that I have done. I think that it stands on its own 2 feet, and I think it will withstand the test of time. I think that my library of information and work here is important and valuable, even if some other people don't. I hope that eventually it becomes more popular than it is now. But in terms of pride, it's hard to put something at the top of the list. All the things I've listed are so, you know, going back to the university. I think the other thing I'll say, and then I'll wrap, and then I'll move on, is going back to school and getting a degree. And because this was the second hardest thing I ever had to do. It was, the RPF was hard. So was this, you know, damn, was it hard. And, you know, when I'm just going to say this, you know, I'm not going to belabor the point, but when you work this hard for something and you know you earned it and you know how much work that took and you know the plateaus of learning and work and research that you had to climb and conquer to get that done. And any of y'all who have ever done, you know, post-grad work, you know what I'm talking about. You know, this shit ain't easy. It's not a walk in the park. And if it is, you're doing it wrong. You know, to have anybody out there, you know, talking about, you know, me going to a diploma mill or some university mill or something, or just, you know, that this doesn't mean anything and that I'm engaging in some kind of fraud against people is so hurtful. It's just so unbelievably stupid to say something like that, you know, about this work. So anyway, sorry. Move right off of that now. Let's carry on. Jehovah's Witness apostate. Are there some Scientologists who get treatment for their cancer and actually survive instead of dying from the cancer? Yes. Yes, there are. Not everybody in Scientology is anti-medicine. Not everybody ignores doctors. And yes, people in Scientology will go get medical treatment and they will get fixed. It happens. Absolutely. It's really hard to know whether there is an overabundance of cancer in Scientology or not. You know, a lot of Scientologists die of cancer, but the fact is a lot of people die of cancer. It's a really common way to go. So it's really hard for me to know if there's an overrepresentation of cancer victims in Scientology, but it's not, it wouldn't be accurate to say that nobody in Scientology ever, you know, gets chemotherapy. Hell, a woman I was on the RPF with was getting chemotherapy for her breast cancer. I believe it was breast cancer. It might have been. I think so. Anyway, she had some form of cancer, and she was, you know, wasted most of the time, just you know, really not in a good way, energetic, you know, energy level-wise, because, you know, it was taking so much out of her while she was getting through an RPF. You know? So, anyway, yeah. Scientologists do that. Ex-Scion, does anyone ever have to actually pay fines for breaking a non-disclosure agreement? They almost made Debbie Cook do that. They really tried, but I think that was the sort of make-break point for them on their NDAs, right? yeah, I've not seen it. I've not seen anybody successfully prosecuted or made to pay fines for not following their NDA from the Church of Scientology. Other groups, most definitely. Other places in the world, yes, absolutely. Other instances, but not Scientologically. I haven't seen that. Maybe there's been cases of it. I haven't seen it. All right, Bingo McMahon. To what extent has the Church of Scientology tried to reform itself? Like with the JWs and the change in clothing and stuff, right? We see concessions being made. We see changes being made in Scientology over the last 20 years as a result of the PR flaps and exposure that has been made of them. If the exposure hadn't happened, Scientology would not have changed. I can guarantee you that. It's the nature of the organization and the nature of cults. But They have made some reforms. They no longer confiscate passports automatically on the Freewinds or in other places at Flag, I believe. They've stopped doing that. It's highly illegal. They should never have been doing that. It's absolutely a huge red flag of human trafficking when any organization or group is mandatorily confiscating people's IDs, passports, or other, other personal items. They have reduced the volume, you could say. They've kind of lowered the volume on the whole enforced abortion issue. Now they've changed it over to where they sort of mandate birth control, even surgical birth control on their members. So I don't know if you'd really consider that a reform or not. I kind of don't. I don't think mandatory vasectomies and that sort of thing are any, you know, that starts smacking of eugenics even. I mean, it just gets really bad. It's not eugenics, but you know what I mean? It starts going in these weird directions. They've tried to put on a better appearance. They've tried to make it out that they are LGBT friendly, and there are LGBT members now at the lower levels. I think those people are in for a rude awakening when they hit clear in the OT levels, because I don't think that they've changed their policies in regards to security, and considering that, you know, people in the 1-1 band of the tone scale are not good security risks, right? So I think that's a thing. Yeah. Okay. So yeah, those are some of the things. Couple revisions, couple reformations, not really much of anything, to be honest. I do want to, one of the things you are going to see me, to what extent, somebody asked here, love Jonathan Streeter, see if he'll come back on for some more shows. I absolutely want to do that. I do want to put together in the future more Three Apostate episodes. We won't have the Lloyd Evans back, but maybe I can get Jonathan back and I can bring somebody else in. I would love to find somebody maybe from Islam or some other kind of, you know, representative of a more radicalized kind of group. I'd love to compare and contrast with that. That might be fun. Okay, let's see what else we got here. Scott, your question is not in the question queue. So if you want to ask me a question, you got to get it in that queue. So put it below that comment there so I can see it. I'm sort of seeing some of the comments as I'm going, but I'm paying a lot more attention to the question box here. Joe DiCeppo, did you see Alex's protest in London this week? Any thoughts? I did not watch the whole thing. I saw little bits and pieces, right? I heard that he had brought a cake and that that Charlie Wakely sort of stomped on it or something. I thought that was kind of mean. I heard that another friend of mine went and watched, and he said that the interactions were really good, that generally speaking, people were interacting well with the staff. There was one person who was kind of cutting somebody off a few times or something, and that wasn't really great. But otherwise, the protest seemed to go really, really well. It was kind of, you know, two thumbs up across the boards on the thing. And that's the feedback I heard on it. And Alex was certainly happy. I spoke with him last night. So, they killed the cake. Yeah, exactly. I thought that was just unusually and significantly cruel. And I understand the mindset. I get it. I get where the Scientologists are sitting. They are not happy right now. You know, the protests are bringing pressure on Scientology staff. They are the ones who are probably feeling the brunt of it. The Sea Org and PAC base are probably the other ones who are feeling the brunt of it. But if your goal is to only make cult members uncomfortable or mad or upset with you, that kind of sucks as a goal, to be honest with you. It doesn't really resolve or change or help anybody or anything. If your goal is to bring exposure and awareness, you know, to this, That's not the best way to go about bringing exposure and awareness to it, because all you're doing is showing the world how you can make other people mad. What would be impressive is if, you know, there was a conversational one out of Denver last week where there was actually engagement with the Scientologist in a not a necessarily friendly way, but certainly not overtly antagonistic or hostile. That I don't make a practice of watching a lot of the protest videos. I just don't. I don't have time for it, and I don't have an inclination to be honest with you. But this particular one, it being in Denver, and Jeff, PTS for Life, talking about it on his channel, I was like, what's this about? So I watched that one. And I think that there could be, you know, constructive protesting and auditing and that sort of thing. But, I thought it was a little indicative of the pressure that the staff are feeling and the anger that is present in them that can be targeted toward a protester that cannot be targeted to their seniors, to their fellow staff, right? The actual people who are oppressing the staff can't be gotten mad at, can't be targeted. But they can target those protesters, and they can target that cake, and they can target that kindness. You know, and it becomes a kind of cruel viciousness. And that's really sad. You know, I hope those folks, I hope that there's more seed planting going on there than is apparent in the videos I've seen. I hope that there's more work being done in that direction, because that's where it can be amazing. That's where you can do really, really good work with that. Okay. Jehovah's Witness apostate clarifies something we said earlier here. JW still can't associate with disfellowship people. They can only give a greeting when these people come to the congregation for the meeting. Baby steps, huh? Baby steps. Oh, sure, Joe DiCeppo. This is a great question. What's the deal with all the LRH books called 8-something or titles with 8s in them? Okay, great question. Real simple. Hubbard uses the letter or the number 8 as symbolic for the concept of infinity or eternity. 8 is the infinity symbol turned on its side. And so the book, these are formulas for auditing, if you can believe this. That sounds nuts, right? 8808 is maybe the best example I can give you, the simplest one. You achieve immortality or infinity or eternity, the initial 8, by taking the apparent infinity the apparent infinity of the physical universe and reducing it to 0, and taking the apparent 0 of you as a spiritual entity and increasing it to infinity. So 8, the first 8, is the infinity you're trying to achieve, and that is achieved by reducing the physical universe's apparent power and influence and infinite power and influence to nothing, and raising your own insignificance to infinite levels of power and ability. That is what 8808 means, that series of letter of numbers. That's a book of Scientology that Hubbard wrote in 1952. And it's the handbook for the Philadelphia doctorate course, where he goes into all of this in grim and gory detail. Some of the most ridiculous claims you will ever hear any human being ever make are in those 1952 Philadelphia lectures. Hubbard says shit in there that is just absolutely batshit. And I have had... like I said, I've talked with electrical engineers and physicists about Hubbard's claims, and I'm serious, they really couldn't stop laughing. Like, I didn't just make that up. They really couldn't stop. It was almost an embarrassing conversation for me. Because I've taken these books. I've taken 880. I've taken 8808. Right, I've taken these things that Hubbard wrote to these guys, and I'm saying, what do you think about this bit and this here? And they're just like, what the hell? They just can't believe it, you know. So that's what those examples. That's what those are. Oh, hey, Mike. See Michael Hobson here. Yes, thank you. Yes. So, believe it or not, I will just say this real fast. Believe it or not, I actually do know my Scientology. It's not directed to you, Mike. It's a off-channel criticism I get also. Oh, Chris never did any training. Chris never... It's like, Jesus Christ, guys. Okay. We are well over an hour here, and I'm going to go through the rest of the questions in the box here. So if you have any more, now is the time to get them in, because I'm going to try to sort of flash answer through the rest of these, okay? Rhyme and reason. What's the craziest experience you can remember from a Scientology event or fundraiser? Any funny or outlandish stories from the theater events or magic shows? LOL. Well, we had a fire almost start in Santa Barbara at a fundraiser one time. That was fun. We had a magic show happening, and a guy tried to do some kind of magic with some fire stuff, and it almost set the org on fire. Let's see. Craziest experience. I mean, that's kind of up there. I don't know. I think it's the cosplay that comes to my mind right now. That is kind of crazy. It gets really out of hand, a little out of hand. Yeah, I don't know. I'm fumbling around a little bit on this one, but it's I think the org almost being set on fire was probably the answer to the question. I just can't believe how whack people get with the fundraising. It's such a fake enthusiasm. If you were, you know, you see these photos. Most of what you all see are photographs from the fundraisers. But if you're there. And I've been at hundreds of fundraisers in Scientology, I feel like, at this point. It's tense. There's a tension in those rooms, you know? It's different from other fundraisers I've been to that have nothing to do with Scientology. I've been to some other ones just to compare how it felt. And it was a little bit more laid back. It was a little bit chiller. The Scientology ones, everybody's on edge. Oh, it's just this really tense, anxious experience, and everybody's got these fake smiles. Hey, oh, we're all happy here, right? This is a good thing, right? You know, and the people on stage, these poor schleps, man, they got to go up there and just like act and you know, hey, we're all so happy today. This is all so great, you know. Drives me crazy. It's so fake. So fake. All right. Yeah, it's true. Is it true that Charles Manson didn't actually commit any of the Tate LaBianca murders himself? Yes, that is true. He did not kill anybody. Charles Manson was a ringleader. He was an influence, you could say, an influencer of the worst kind. But no, he did not kill anybody. All right. OBG Foster, does the Church of Scientology still declare oppositional never-ends suppressive persons? Would never-ends know if they were? The church policy is not to declare people who are not former Scientologists, as I understand it. I have never once seen or heard of a declare order being issued on a non-Scientologist. What I have seen many, many examples of is groups and individuals being put on a sort of list of suppressive groups and activities. So without having a formal declare, they're simply put on a list of undesirables or people who've attacked the church or media outfits or organizations not to be trusted. You know, that kind of thing. And it's a pretty big list. It's like, you know, pages and pages of all the groups and activities and individuals who must not ever be spoken of or spoken to. And I think that's kind of how they declare never-ends, as opposed to people who have been Scientologists, who they actually have real dirt on in their PC folders and ethics files and things like that. And it's from those that they make their declare order, that they draw up the list of crimes and everything they've committed. And that all of them are violations of church policies. See, it's hard to declare somebody who never agreed to those policies in the first place is kind of the bottom line logic on that. People are declared suppressive because they agreed to follow the church's policies and then they don't do so. That's what makes you suppressive. So in order to declare, that's what earns you your declare order, I should say. You can be suppressive or considered suppressive, and you are violating the church's policies, but you never agreed to follow the church's policies as a never-in. So you're just some outside external influence or element that they need to bar and block away from influencing Scientologists. The way they do that is they put you on that list. That's my understanding of how the church operates on that. I am 10 years out, so it might be that they've changed and are doing something different these days on the justice lines, but that's certainly how it has been, and I haven't seen any indication of that changing in all this time. Okay, let's move on here. Joe DiCeppo, LRH had a baby formula? What? I need to hear more about this. How bizarre. Is it as medically competent as his other suggestions? I have been told that it is. I am told that L. Ron Hubbard's baby formula is horrible for kids in terms of health, but I don't know. Again, that's not my, raising little babies is something I never got to do in my life. So I babysat a lot of kids, but I never had to deal with the baby formula part. So I don't really know what I'm talking about there. So I don't want to give a judgment of this that it would be wrong, factually wrong. So I can't really speak to it. But maybe you're, inciting me here to go look this up and find out. So maybe ask me in a couple of weeks and I'll have a better answer for you. Do you know, OBG Foster, do you know of people who died due to the RPF or Purif while doing it? Yes, I do. I am aware of a man in Sacramento who had a heart condition. This was in the 1990s. I was overseeing the management of the technical divisions in Scientology across the West U.S., so I was not directly involved in this. I was overseeing from L.A., and a report came in that a guy had had a heart attack and died, and that he was doing the purification rundown. He did not die in the sauna. He died at home after doing a five-hour stint in the sauna. And this was, a week or two or three into the purification program. It wasn't day one or day two. He was well into the program. And I was forced to, I was shocked and appalled that this had happened. I considered at the time that something really grossly wrong had happened and that somebody had fucked up real hard. And I was, ready to put a head on a pike and go after somebody in Sacramento for screwing up the Purif, because I was under the impression at the time that the purification rundown didn't kill people and wasn't medically harmful. I was very wrong about that assessment, but that was my training at the time. So I wanted to nail, whoever was technically responsible for this, because it was, this was not good. This was the worst possible outcome. Well, that lasted for about 10 minutes, and then OSA came down and took every single document, every single piece of communication having anything to do with that death, and they took it all and they erased it all, everything. No written reports, no electronic reports, no digital communications, nothing. And it could not ever be talked about, spoken about, referred to in any way from this point forward. That was what I was... Those were the orders I was given in my face by Pam Bowen, the deputy commanding officer for external OSA West U.S. at the time. I have talked about this before. So I believe Pam Bowen is now dead, and Pam Bowen is one of those five people I've talked about who, just shark eyes. There's just no life in her eyes. She was absolutely lifeless. I felt like I was talking to a vampire when I was talking to her. She was just a ruthlessly cold person. So that's the one I am most immediately and directly aware of in terms of deaths in Scientology. I have heard of other instances of this, of course, and we have the deaths at Narconon. There were deaths at Narconon, I think Oklahoma, and I believe a couple other places. There were more than one. And Oklahoma totally screwed the pooch on following up on that. I think it was Oklahoma. Tony Ortega reported on all of this in detail. Not the Sacramento one that I've just told you about, because nobody ever reported on that one. That happened years and years ago, and obviously, for all the reasons I just said, I have no proof of or evidence of any of that, right? But I did later confirm with somebody who was also an ex-member, yes, that absolutely happened. Yes, it was absolutely shut down by OSA, and no, there wasn't anything we could ever do about it to follow up or investigate on it. But the Narcanon deaths were investigated, were followed up on, but no real consequences, as I understand it, other than shutting down Narcanon in those states. All right. Xion, Chris, is your next tattoo going to say why so serious? Yes, it is. And it's going to be right here, and I will get it there. I've had plans for it for years. I've just never had the disposable income and time to go do it. But I am absolutely going to do that. This tattoo here is, it is Chaos Be Kind, which comes from Michelle McNamara, Patton Oswalt's deceased wife. She said this, he put this out in a comedy special that he did, and it was the most touching four words I have ever heard in my life, and basically my mantra. So I thought, let's remind myself of that every day. But why so serious is the other one that I also have to remind myself of. So, yeah, I'm going to put that on there. Rhyme and Reason, can you explain the difference between Scientology International on Hollywood Boulevard versus the INT base? What is the building directly across from the HGB with the Sea Org emblem on it? Oh, great questions. Okay, here's what I can tell you. There are multiple levels of organizational management of Scientology internationally. This used to be more true than it is now. Now it's basically a dictatorship, and it has been for quite some time. But there is this apparency of upper management, middle management, and lower management. The way Scientology divides up the world is by continental zones. So you have a Western United States, Eastern United States, Latin America, Canada, Europe, UK, ANZO, Australia, New Zealand, Oceania is a continent. Italy is a continent. So they have these different zones. Each one of those zones is managed by a continental liaison office. That's your lower level management. The Hollywood Guarantee Building on Hollywood Boulevard, the HGB, is your middle management section. It's sort of the upper middle management. If the lower continental management at each of the zones, right? That's like the level I worked at, is the lower middle management. HGB, Hollywood Guarantee Building, is upper middle management. The Gold Base used to be the location of international management, where the mainline programming and strategic initiatives and the people who set the course for Scientology strategically to move forward into the world, that's the INT base level. That's the international management. That consisted of the International Management Executive Committee, the Watchdog Committee, CMO International. There's lots of abbreviations and acronyms for these different organizations that together form International Management of Scientology. All of this is broken down in a video that I made years and years ago, one of the most popular videos on my channel, called Scientology Organizational Madness. And I gave little animations and and charts and stuff, and I showed all of this. But that's basically the explanation for it. So when you're looking at the 12-story building on Hollywood Boulevard, you are looking at upper middle management of Scientology. That's basically how it breaks down. I could get into details all day long. I'm not going to. That's the basic breakdown of it. I hope that helps clarify. Across the street from the HGB, that other building that has the Sea Org emblem on it, last I knew, that's the International Landlord Office. And that's the building that they operate out of to plan, organize, and build their new ideal orgs. That's what that structure is about. Okay. Moving on here. We are almost wrapping up. Oh, Chaotic Kitten, have you talked to Telltale before about cults and JWs? Many, many years ago, Telltale and I had a little relationship on YouTube. We did some videos back and forth. Great guy. You're talking about Owen Morgan. And he's somebody I want to reach back out to later this year because I want to see what he's up to. I haven't talked or heard from him in quite a while. All right. Kenneth Kaminsky, what are your thoughts on Joseph Smith? I think Joseph Smith was an earlier incarnation of L. Ron Hubbard. I think Joseph Smith was a con man extraordinaire. I think he was a sexual abuser and assaulter, and I think he was an overall scumbag and con man. That's what I think about Joseph Smith. Moving right along. Chaotic Kitten, have you ever talked to Telltale about other cults? He's an ex-JW. Yes, you asked me. Yeah, so yes, I have. We've done whole shows about Scientology and JWs and stuff. That was all years ago, though. I know that's very, very old, ancient content for people, and we'll have to do some new stuff. So we'll get, I'm going to reach out to him later this year. I'm trying to wrap up some other stuff and then get into the bigger cult world again, right? I just got to wrap up the Scientology stuff, and then I've got this other project I need to get done, and I'll be working on that real hard for a few months, and then we'll get to this other stuff. Okay. Oh yeah, no problem. Okay, so we are good. I've reached. Yes. Okay, good. I think I've answered all the questions today. We've had a nice chunky show today. I hope you all enjoyed your time here, and that this was helpful, informative, educational, entertaining, all of that. Thanks for coming around and watching. Please support the channel. And of course, if you have any need for personal consultation, one-on-one, anything like that, you can contact me. I am not a counselor or therapist. I will not give you therapy, but I will give you guidance, advice, education, assistance, and be somebody to listen to you with an understanding ear. Those are the things I can offer. So if you would like that, or you have cult intervention kind of activities up your sleeve or something that you need help with in terms of a friend or family member who is involved in a cult, you can contact me about that as well. All right. I will see you guys. Well, I'll see you tomorrow for the Tony and I will be recording our show probably in about half an hour now. So I'm going to do that after Scientology Straight Up and Vertical with him, and that'll be posted tomorrow, and we'll see what we see for the rest of the week. Again, thank you very much for your support, for your viewership. It means everything to me. It really does. You can see sometimes I get a little strained about some of the nonsense out there, but the fact of the matter is that my focus and attention is on you guys and on giving you the best possible content that I can. Doing my best. All right, so I'll see you guys soon. Bye-bye.